Historic is the word that we're hearing about President Obama's remarks on Monday, placing the issue of same-sex marriage squarely in line with the struggles for equality of blacks and women. With the words Seneca Falls, Selma, and Stonewall, the president dropped some political poetry that was music to some people's ears. Good morning, I'm Veronica Rickert, and I'm in this week for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour is Catherine Frankie. She's a professor of law and the director at the Center for Gender and Sexuality Law at Columbia. And we're always up for hearing what's on your mind. What did you make of President Obama's historic remarks about gay marriage? Is he foreshadowing the cases coming before the Supreme Court this spring? And has America turned a corner on the issue of same-sex marriage? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send an email instead to talk@WPR.org. And Catherine Frankie, welcome.
Well, thank you, Veronica. It's a delight to be with you.
Well, I want to take a little bit of a listen to what the president said on Monday. Lots of us have heard this already, but here we go.
Our journey is not complete until our gay brothers and sisters are treated like anyone else under the law. For if we are truly created equal, then surely the love we commit to one another must be equal as well.
Just a sampling of what President Obama said on Monday that caught the attention of a lot of people. It's been called historic. What do you think, Catherine?
Well, we all were looking forward to seeing what President Obama's second inauguration address would sound like, and we all wanted to be moved like we were the first time. But I have to say, I don't think there was a dry eye in the lesbian and gay community listening to him include and recognize us in a way that really, as you say, was historical.
So tell me about how big a deal this was for the gay and lesbian community to hear this, and also about the shockwaves or the after effects of these words as they ripple out into the political community.
Well, as you know, and I know your listeners know, the change around gay rights and particularly marriage rights in the last 10 years have been meteoric. I don't think we can compare it to any other civil rights movement, whether it's the movement for the rights of African Americans in the U.S. or women. The ways in which we're now seeing not only the president acknowledge a kind of citizenship for lesbian and gay people, but the courts are doing so as well, as are state legislatures across the country. It's a kind of change that I would never have predicted would happen so quickly, even 10 years ago. We weren't even dreaming that marriage would be something that same-sex couples might enjoy. So to have the president build a recognition of gay rights, not just marriage rights, but gay rights more generally, into his inauguration speech, not once but several times, was just phenomenal. And certainly one thing he was doing was saying thank you to the gay community for supporting him in his reelection. But as you acknowledge, the Supreme Court also has a couple of very important gay rights cases this term. And the most important member of that court, Justice Kennedy, was sitting right next to President Obama as he said these historic words. So,
and he used the words under the law at some point.
He sure did. He was talking about civil rights and marriage and linking, really almost signaling a kind of handoff of the legacy of the civil rights traditions in the United States from the black civil rights movement, women's rights movement, and now the gay rights movement. And quite clearly, he had the justices in mind when he did that kind of rhetorical linking.
Well, the black civil rights link is interesting because the black civil rights movement hasn't always agreed that their journey is completely analogous to the journey of gays and lesbians who are struggling for gay marriage and other gay rights. Do you think that those differences are perhaps fading?
Well, I don't think anybody would argue that these various civil rights movements are completely analogous. Slavery is a unique horror in American history that was not only a social fact, but it was built into the structure of the Constitution and our founding. And the kind of discrimination and disenfranchisement that gay people have experienced is in no way the same thing as what African Americans have experienced. Nevertheless, when you make new civil rights claims in today's world, one necessarily gestures back to a history of tolerance, of acceptance, of equality, and of liberty. And the paradigmatic case in the United States is that of racial justice. So point in the direction of the norms and values of racial justice when we make claims for gay rights today isn't to say that they're the same mm-hmm. at all, but that they share some similarities and that the values that were at stake in the one case are in interesting ways at stake in the new case.
Now, depending on your perspective and where you're sitting, it might have been shocking to hear the president talk like this, but in fact, there seems to have been a little bit of a sea change over the past 4 years. It looks like the country's approval rate for same-sex marriage is up to 54%, which is, you know, a lot higher than the last time Obama spoke 4 years ago at his first inauguration. What do you think's happened in those 4 years?
Well, it's sort of funny, really, in a very short period of time, being against the marriage rights of same-sex couples is so sort of last year. I think that, as you note, in the polling numbers, it seems that a majority of Americans support marriage equality. President Obama didn't see that he was taking a political risk by endorsing marriage equality during the campaign and then in his inauguration. So I think one of the things he's signaling in including the issue of marriage in so much of his rhetoric is that the justices, when they take these cases up this spring, don't want to be on the wrong side of history.
Hmm.
That train has already left the station. So there are new hard things for us to think about, and I hope we can get to talk about some of those during the hour, but I don't think marriage is one of them anymore.
Well, you know, over the past course of his career, Obama has been accused of kind of campaigning in poetry and needing to govern in prose. So I guess the question here is, what is he going to do to walk the walk now that he said these words?
Well, he has to put some political weight behind the continuing repeal of the Defense of Marriage Act. He's rhetorically repudiated it. The Justice Department will have to write briefs, and the Solicitor General make arguments in the Supreme Court. When those cases come up, and we'll all be watching closely what those arguments look like. You know, he's in a peculiar position of being constitutionally charged with enforcing a law he doesn't believe in, or he says he doesn't believe in, and it puts the Attorney General in a complicated place to both be the defender of a law, but announce that they think it's unconstitutional. And for that reason, we have a kind of peculiar way that the case is coming up in the Supreme Court, where the Justice Department isn't actually defending it any longer. But there are plenty of other issues that arise in the gay rights agenda beyond marriage. Marriage just happens to be the most prominent one, certainly having to do with immigration rights, a topic about which President Obama has not been particularly progressive, and the rights of same-sex couples, whether married or not, or couples and families, regardless of the sexual orientation of the parents, are a huge civil rights agenda issue that Obama has not addressed, I think, adequately in the minds of most people who work on that issue.
And I want to talk about those cases you mentioned coming up. But first, I want to get a primer from you, if we could, on Stonewall, because a lot of people could probably play Seneca Falls and Selma. But Stonewall, if you weren't paying attention, you might have to dig a bit. Tell us about Stonewall.
Well, the Stonewall Inn was a bar in Greenwich Village, frequented by gay people, gay men and lesbians in the 60s and 70s. It's still there now. It's some sort of kind of restaurant, I think, but it's not doesn't quite have the same character it did a number of years ago.
Hmm.
And the New York City Police Department staged a raid of the Stonewall Inn, a very violent raid, and arrested in 1969-68, and arrested a number of the gay and lesbian and cross-dressing people who were there. And the real leaders of that Stonewall riot that ensued within the gay community were gender nonconforming members of our community. The gay community looked quite different then in its public face than it does now. You know, now we have what are really kind of traditional couples lining up and asking to be married. They're not actually asking for something very radical. But the people that were revolted, really, in the streets against the Stonewall arrests were much more radical and were asking not just for equality around marriage and family recognition, but for a kind of sexual rights and liberty that has been lost in so many ways from the gay rights agenda. And there are a number of us are hoping to get it back onto the screen soon.
And is it fair to call this really the launching point of the gay rights movement?
It certainly was. There was a gay rights movement before, but this is really what sparked it. It was sort of the gay Arab Spring, if you will, where there was a form of very coercive police violence brought against members of the community at the Stonewall Inn. And then, for the first time, really, enormous pushback from the community that you just can't treat us like this anymore.
So we're talking 1969 that Stonewall happens. It's now 2013. This has been a long road.
Oh, it certainly has been, but in the history of civil rights movements, not that long. You think about the resistance to racism in this country from before the founding and through enslavement. We fought a civil war. We amended our Constitution several times, and we still haven't achieved the kind of equality that I think Martin Luther King and others dreamed of. And women remain, in the women's rights movement, remain still paid substantially less than men are. We do most of the work at home caring for children and to try to juggle a job if we can. So those movements, which are older, certainly can't claim victory and pack up and go home. So the kind of victories we've seen in the gay rights movement has really been in a collapse pretty short period of time as compared with other civil rights movements in the country. And we still have work to do, too, on gay rights.
And now there were folks that at home, who are present, who are listening to President Obama's words. And some of them, like UM Gathering, had tears in their eyes. And other people thought, you know, this is marriage. It should be a man and a woman. I've read several quotes saying, you know, we don't object to equality, even under the law, but we do object to the redefinition of marriage. And that's still something that Obama's going to have to work through. How do you see that playing out?
Well, that is the discussion we're having, both in the courts and I think in the society more largely, is what is marriage and what are its purposes? And one of the advantages of these lawsuits that have gone on in California, in Iowa, in Connecticut, all over the country, are that the opponents of same-sex marriage have had to come forward and explain why it is that gay people should not be able to marry, same-sex couples should not be able to marry. And they can't just say it's because it's always been that way. That is no longer a legitimate way to justify the exclusion of a set of people from a kind of citizenship. We could say, well, it's always been that way that we've racially segregated our schools, or that women have always stayed at home and men have worked in the wage labor market. Appointing a tradition is no longer a public reason, a legitimate reason for maintaining a status quo that some say is illegitimate or discriminatory. So you have to come forward with some other reason. And that's when the arguments for the exclusion of same-sex couples from marriage run out. Often people will say, well, marriage is an inherently reproductive enterprise. It's about a man and a woman having children within the context of a marriage. Well, not all married couples have children. Not all of the ones who do have them biologically with each other. They adopt. They do other things. So if you really push that argument, it actually doesn't justify the exclusion of same-sex couples from marriage because, after all, a lot of same-sex couples are raising children as well. So
is this going to, just by its nature, the thrust of gay marriage rights, going to alienate the conservative Christian population, or is there movement there too?
Well, you know, the weird thing is a lot of the same-sex couples who want to marry are conservatives, and they're Christian. They're quite traditional. They love the traditions of marriage, just like heterosexuals do. So as I said before, this is not a particularly radical movement. It's actually a very conservative and traditional one. But if we look at a state like Massachusetts that's been marrying same-sex couples for quite a long time now, marriage has not fallen apart. Heterosexuals are not marrying at any slower rate than they were before. Marriage seems to be holding up pretty well in the face of same-sex couples being part of that institution. And the values that conservative Christians adhere to in Massachusetts have not really at the core been threatened. They've actually been reinforced by same-sex couples pledging to the same agreements of fidelity and monogamy and care for one another that heterosexual couples have been pledging to in marriage. So I think those values are changing in terms of the opposition to marriage and for same-sex couples and seeing it as in conflict with conservative values, because they really are the same.
So moving again to the inauguration, it was also interesting to note that just besides President Obama's words about gay marriage and gay equality, there was an openly gay poet who was there delivering a poem. The chaplain who was supposed to deliver the benediction originally was found out to have said some anti-gay remarks, and he was let go and replaced. So there were these flags all through the ceremony that there was something going on.
Well, as I said, it signals a kind of belonging, a kind of recognition and belonging for gay people, and that being openly homophobic, being openly hateful of gay people, just as we would feel with being openly hateful of people on the basis of their race or gender, no longer gives you the credentials to stand on that podium, to represent the American people. So I think in subtle and not so subtle ways, that was one of the signals that President Obama was sending. But he was nesting it within a larger set of values about all of us belonging to one, we the people, was sort of the refrain for his remarks on Monday. That we're all included in that body, and that those who hold intolerant views that want to excise certain of us from that we, the people, are no longer welcome in that conversation.
Well, we're talking this hour with our guest, Catherine Franke. She's a professor of law and the director at the Center for Gender and Sexuality Law at Columbia University. And we're talking about President Barack Obama's remarks in his inaugural address on Monday supporting gay equality and gay marriage, and giving the hint that down the road things are going to be changing, and there are some Supreme Court cases coming up in the spring which will make this even more evident. But we're wondering this hour what you think. What did you make of Barack Obama's historic remarks about gay marriage? And do you think that federal law will change when it comes to same-sex marriage? Should it change? We'd love to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or if you'd rather, send your email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert back with you today. I'm in this week for Kathleen Dunn here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And coming up at 10 o'clock, fear is an emotion that all living creatures feel. After 10, we'll talk to a journalist and an author who sets out to better understand fear by speaking to leading neuroscientists and extreme athletes, and even by swimming with great white sharks. That's coming up after 10 o'clock. We'll be talking The Fear Project. This hour, we're joined by Catherine Franke. She's a professor of law and the director of the Center for Gender and Sexuality Law at Columbia University. We're talking about President Barack Obama's remarks regarding gay rights and gay marriage in his inaugural address, and wondering what you thought about that. Do you think it was, are you one of the people who thought it was high time to hear something that strong coming from the president? Was it too much? Do you feel that at this point the country is there already? And that President Barack Obama is just sort of voicing what people have been thinking, or is he pushing the envelope? What do you think? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or send your email to talk@wpr.org. And Catherine, we've alluded to a couple of these Supreme Court cases coming up in the spring. And I think, as I hear it, the most important is Proposition 8. Can you tell us about that?
Well, there are two cases. The Prop 8 case was the case brought in California challenging Proposition 8, which was a statewide initiative that defined marriage as a constitutional matter in the state of California as a union of one man and one woman. So it had the effect of barring any legality for same-sex marriages in California. Two lawyers who were not part of the gay community, David Boies and Ted Olson, the so-called Dream Team, decided that they would head out to California and initiate a lawsuit challenging Proposition 8 as a federal constitutional matter that it violated the liberty rights and equal protection rights of same-sex couples in California. One curious footnote about the case is that Boies and Olson initiated this case over the objections of members of the gay community, the lawyers in the gay community that had been working on this issue in California and elsewhere for quite some time. Kathleen and I spoke about this a couple months ago when the court took the case. And so there's some interesting background politics about why this case now. But for whatever, for better or for worse, here we are, and the Supreme Court has taken the case after a trial court judge in California found Proposition 8 to be unconstitutional, that it violated the rights of same-sex couples to marry. And so the question is before the Supreme Court on a very weird procedural issue that only really lawyers will find interesting. But it derives from the fact that the state of California was not interested in defending Prop 8. Jerry Brown, a progressive or liberal governor, said, you know what, I don't agree with Prop 8. It wasn't my law. It was a proposition that the people in private parties proposed in California, and I'm not going to defend it. I think it's unconstitutional myself. And so there was a problem in California who was going to stand up in court and defend the law. So what they did is they got the proponents of the proposition itself, the private actors who organized the money and the signatures and the campaign to get Prop 8 passed. They stood in the shoes of the state in the litigation to defend Proposition 8 and the bar on same-sex couples marrying. So it raises what we call as a standing question. Who has the right to stand in the shoes of the of Proposition 8 to defend it? So it's possible, very possible, that the Supreme Court will only address that standing issue and never get to the merits of the question of same-sex marriage in California. It's possible. The Defense of Marriage Act case, the Windsor case, which the court also took, raises a quite a different question, which is the constitutionality of a federal law that President Clinton signed called the Defense of Marriage Act that defines for federal purposes that marriage is a union of one man and one woman. So all federal benefits, whether it's tax benefits, immigration, employment benefits, if, you know, if you're a gay person and you work for a federal agency and you want to put your partner or your spouse, if you're legally married in your state, on your health plan, the federal government won't allow that to happen. You have to be in a heterosexual marriage to put your spouse on your health plan. So for every aspect of the federal government's benefits, marriage is limited to marriages between two people of different sexes, not same sexes. And so Edie Windsor challenged that law, basically claiming that she should not have been saddled with an enormous tax bill when her wife died, which tax bill she would not have had to pay had her wife been a husband. So that there the real question of discrimination against gay marriages, same-sex marriages, is before the court. So these two cases will be argued one day after the other this spring. They raise quite different questions, and one of the things that I think those of us who are watching these cases closely have found very interesting about them is that both of the cases, the way the court framed the questions that they're going to decide, have technical legal escape valves. So I told you the standing issue in the Prop 8 case. There's another technical legal question in the Windsor case that is too boring to describe right now. But it's there, and those of us who are watching the cases closely think that the both sides of this issue on the court, whether it's those who we suspect might support marriage rights for same-sex couples or those who we're pretty confident oppose it, like Justice Scalia or Justice Thomas or Roberts, wanted to preserve an escape valve to deal with the technicality just in case they didn't have the votes. So we'll see. It could be a fizzle in terms of a big sea change when the court decides these cases,
right,
if they decide to just use these technicalities to get rid of them. Or it could be enormous, enormous loss or enormous win, depending on which side you're on. So we have no idea.
Well, I want to talk more about that. But first, let's take a caller now. We've got John on the line from Burlington, Vermont. Hi, John.
Hi, Veronica. Thank you so much for this show.
Sure.
I just wanted to call in. My husband and I are born and raised in Wisconsin, but when we wanted to get married, this was almost 7 years ago, we had to leave Wisconsin. We had to go to Ontario to get married because our state didn't recognize our love as equal to those of our straight counterparts. And ever since then, we've been marriage equality activists. You know, we were married just 8 months before Wisconsin put its marriage discrimination amendment onto the Constitution. So to hear the President of the United States, you know, in last May come out for marriage equality, and now to mention our movement for our civil rights in his inaugural address was just absolutely monumental. And I just wanted to thank the guests for, referring to the LGBT rights movement as a civil rights movement, and, you know, because and remarking about the significance of hearing this, you know, hearing the first African American president put Stonewall on the same platform as Selma, because, you know, I feel like there's a tendency among a lot of LGBT people to shy away from those comparisons in a lot of cases, because, you know, because obviously race and sexual orientation are different, and, you know, and LGBT people weren't enslaved. But I mean, you know, to me, that seems like we're constructing hierarchies of oppression. And B, if you look at history, gay people have been lobotomized, put into concentration camps. So, you know, I mean, and for me, at the very fundamental level, you know, I can no more change my orientation than women can change their gender, or than African Americans or other racial minorities can change their racial identity. So, you know, it's discrimination against a group of people for a fundamental ingredient of their humanity. So, you know, I really do believe, and it sounds like President Obama does as well, that the struggle for LGBT rights is a struggle for civil rights. And that was just a really, really historic development and brought tears to my eyes and joy to my heart as an LGBT activist and as a married gay man.
Well, John, thank you so much for your call. I appreciate your thoughts, and I thank you for sharing your story as well. And John pointing out how, and as you pointed out, Catherine, that by placing Stonewall up there with Selma, he's pointing out foundational similarities, and it looks like that will be the platform from now on.
I think so. He's drawn a new baseline for us of what it means to be a just and fair and tolerant nation. And, you know, the inauguration address is a very different political exercise than the State of the Union address. And what he did in that speech was say, these are my values, these are American values. I'm going to have to compromise with my legislative agenda, just as my opponents are, but I'm going to set it out there now that this is what I think America stands for, and it's what I stand for. And it was a very moving speech in that respect. Not only for the inclusion of gay people in those our rights in those values, but for the broad sense of we're all in this together. And when we cut off parts of our community, whether it's because they're poor or they're immigrants or they're gay or they're people of color, we all lose something. And it was just a moving, moving articulation of those kinds of values.
One thing I wonder, why do you think these remarks came now? He's been criticized in the past for not being vocal enough in support of gay rights. What made this the moment to say these things?
Well, he doesn't have to run for election again. And he saw that there wasn't a big negative backlash when he endorsed marriage equality. Joe Biden kind of forced him out of the closet on that, which I guess Vice President Biden kind of does that from time to time. By speaking off script, but I think President Obama took a lesson from the fact that he was not hurt. In fact, he was helped by coming out in favor of marriage equality and by repudiating the Defense of Marriage Act and by welcoming gay rights into the history and tradition of civil rights in this country. So he's a smart politician. He's paying attention to how the public responds to the things he says. And it's not a risky thing now to say that you're in support of gay rights and marriage equality. Indeed, I think in short order, it will be a risky thing to say you're not.
Well, that's exactly right. It's not a risky thing now. Do you hold that against him, that he waited for the waters to be safe?
Well, you know, he's got many agendas on his plate. This is only one of them. It was the most full-throated endorsement of our recognition and equality that we've ever heard a national politician articulate, and certainly not a president. So, yes, it would have been lovely if he'd said it in his first inauguration address, but to be honest, I think it would have been politically somewhat reckless for him to do so. President Clinton, in his first term, very early on, said some things about wanting to repeal the exclusion of gay people from the military, and he got backstabbed or, you know, he got tricked, basically, by the right into endorsing Don't Ask, Don't Tell. It backfired. So I think the Obama administration was watching how some of the missteps of the Clinton administration of getting out ahead of an issue too early. And as we've seen with the Obama administration, we were actually able to go further with his patience on this issue than with the kind of early enthusiasm we saw for gay rights in the Clinton administration and then significant retreats and losses as a result.
Well, thank you for that call. And let's go next to Steve. Steve joins us from Richfield. Hi, Steve.
Hi.
Hey, go ahead.
I just wanted to confirm whether I heard something correctly earlier in the program. I believe your guest said something about people who have opposing views, those people and those views need to be excluded or will be excluded from the discourse in the future. And that's rather startling. It's not what liberal-minded people are supposed to be saying. And if indeed people with opposing views are excluded from discourse, what recourse do they have other than very, you know, uncivilized actions?
Hey, Steve, I think I was either I misspoke or I was a little misunderstood. What I meant by exclusion was exclusion on the platform of the inauguration day. That I don't think that was a time when President Obama was going to allow voice to a range of issues on various civil rights issues. He was establishing a baseline on this issue, knowing that he was going to go into a public fora, whether it's in the Congress or in other political venues, where these issues are still being debated. So my point was not to say that those who oppose marriage equality or have a different view on gay rights can no longer speak on those issues, but more I was talking about access to that political forum, the inauguration address.
Thanks for the clarification.
No, I'm glad you raised it because I'm sure you weren't the only one who took that away.
All right. Thank you so much for calling, Steve. And how about we go next to Eric, calling from Berlin. Hey, Eric.
Yeah, good morning, or yes, it's morning. I've got a question. I've been living abroad for 10 years because I can't live in the United States with my partner. And so we've been following the Supreme Court cases with a lot of interest, and I would just like to hear from your guest because she sounds like an expert in exactly this topic. What does she see as the best possible scenario of the Supreme Court decisions if they really all go our way, and what would she see as, like, the most negative scenario? Just what sort of spectrum are we looking at?
Good question. Thanks.
Thanks, Erica. It is an excellent question. The best scenario is for the Supreme Court to recognize that the exclusion of same-sex couples from federal recognition under the DOMA law or the way that federal policy now works creates a form of unconstitutional discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. We have a long history of jurisprudence from the Supreme Court on racial equality, on sexual equality, and the court has begun a little bit to put its toe into the issue of whether sexual orientation-based discrimination should be seen in the same ways that we look in race and sex discrimination, but it hasn't quite said it yet. And so these cases give them the opportunity to say, unless you've got a very good reason for treating straight people and gay people differently when it comes to marriage, and so far we haven't heard one, this violates the Equal Protection Clause of the U.S. Constitution to exclude gay people from the institution of marriage. It could be wonderful and soaring. And Justice Kennedy is up to it. He will probably write the opinion or at least be the deciding vote in the case, whichever way it goes. The worst thing that could happen is that they say there's actually no connection between the civil rights traditions on race and sex and what we're seeing now. Marriage is a traditional institution comprised of a man and a woman. It's essentially reproductive in nature. Two people of the same sex can't make babies, and therefore the states are legitimate in excluding same-sex couples from marriage. And that civil unions or domestic partnerships are a fine, separate, but equal institution that states are entitled to create. There's no discrimination in creating those separate institutions. I don't think the court will say that. I'm fairly confident it won't. if they're going to not rule in favor of gay rights, they will probably rule against it in a way that hides the bigotry that underwrites what I just described. They might do it procedurally, they might do it in more subtle ways, but the court, as I said before, doesn't want to be on the wrong side of history, and issuing a homophobic opinion is probably not what they're going to do.
I have heard that there is pressure for the Obama administration to send something over to the Supreme Court saying that they believe that, for instance, Proposition 8 is unconstitutional, to get a little more involved in what's going on beyond rhetoric. Have you heard this?
Well, the Obama administration is not defending the Defense of Marriage Act. The House put together a committee, and they hired private lawyers to defend the Defense of Marriage Act in federal court. So what the Obama administration said a number of years ago is that we will enforce the Defense of Marriage Act, meaning we will abide by its requirements because it's a validly enacted law, but we will not defend it in court because we think it's unconstitutional. So they've already taken that position.
So is there anything more that Obama can do?
Well, they have to craft an argument about why it's unconstitutional. And there are a number of different ways in which to claim that DOMA violates the Constitution. Some of them I like better than others. So the argument I just made about equality is the argument I prefer. But another argument they could make is that marriage is a fundamental right. Everybody should have an entitlement to marriage, no matter who they are, whether they're heterosexual or homosexual. Robust adult life should include marriage, and not allowing people to marry casts them into a domain of shame and disgrace that we normally think about illegitimacy and sex outside of marriage, and that being able to participate in the institution of marriage dignifies those relationships that that qualify for marriage. I don't favor that argument, because I don't want to set marriage up as the only legitimate form of family. There are lots and lots of people in this country who have complex family relationships. They can't marry. They choose not to marry. There are lots of reasons why people are unmarried. And I think marriage is fine for those who want to enter into it, but I don't want to set it up as the exalted institution that dignifies relationships, and those who live on the outside of marriage live with a kind of shame and the brand of illegitimacy. So I hope the Obama administration doesn't make that argument.
Well, our guest this hour is Catherine Franke. She's a professor of law and director at the Center for Gender and Sexuality Law at Columbia University. And we're taking a look at the historic remarks of Barack Obama at his inauguration on Monday, where he placed the gay rights movement squarely within the civil rights spectrum, with Seneca Falls, with Selma, and obviously getting behind that movement. And Catherine Franke this hour saying the Supreme Court does not want to be on the wrong side of history either. So we're kind of gauging which way the winds of history are flowing right now in terms of gay marriage and gay rights, and wondering what you thought about those remarks on Monday. Is it time? Is the nation ready for this, more than ready for this? And what do you expect from these Supreme Court cases coming down the line? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. I'm Veronica Rickert, in for Kathleen Dunn, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert back with you. I'm in this week for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. As we take a look at Barack Obama's remarks about Monday during his inauguration about the issue in support, actually, of same-sex marriage and what it might mean. These are considered historic words by many, and many in the gay community were overjoyed to be hearing these words. And we're wondering sort of what the ramifications are, what's next, and what action are we going to see following these words coming in the next 4 years. Our guest is Catherine Franke. She's a professor of law and director at the Center for Gender and Sexuality Law at Columbia University. And back to the phones, we have Gary joining us next from Watertown. Hi, Gary.
Yes, I can be brief. The Bible is against homosexuality, and those people will go to hell.
Well, thank you for the call. And Gary is, you know, echoing the sentiment of a group of people that are out there who are vocal about this. And it's something the president will have to work with. What do you think, Catherine?
It's true. I know many people hold that view. The United States is made up of people from many religious traditions, some of them quite conservative or fundamental. But remember, we do have a First Amendment that separates church and state, or church, state and religion, but also protects the right of religious freedom, that protects Gary's rights to believe what he wishes. But we can't use those beliefs as the basis of public law. That's what the separation of religion and state stands for. So he has the right to say what he wants to say and believe what he wants to believe, but those beliefs, those private religious beliefs, can't be the foundation of how we pass laws for all of us in the United States, those who believe what Gary believes and those who don't.
Okay, well, thank you so much for calling, Gary. And we move to Nathan in North Freedom. Hi, Nathan.
Hi, thanks.
Sure.
I'm all for civil rights, equal rights under the law for every American. But if we redefine marriage to allow it to be anything other than between a man and a woman, don't we open the door to redefine it further to allow for maybe three individuals or an individual and an animal? And at what point do we draw the line? It sounds kind of like chaos to me.
Well, this is a common argument that if you make any change, then you're inviting all change. And this was a very common argument when we were dealing with racial equality in the United States, particularly the taking on the law that prohibited people of different races from marrying. The exact same argument came up in court and in the public opinion about what if we let people who are black and white marry, then people will want to marry somebody of the same sex, they want to marry their pets. Many, many other people will want to marry. Marriage will no longer be a monogamous institution. So that same slippery slope that if we open the door a crack, then everything, the parade of horribles, will enter into this institution was articulated in the 40s and 50s and 60s when we were dealing with interracial marriage. That didn't happen then. It's not going to happen now. We're in control of this process, and we get to decide within the confines of constitutional principles what marriage means. So no one is going to be forced to amend laws to include animals and children and multiple partners just because we allow same-sex couples to marry. Now, as was certainly the case back in the 60s and 70s when we were dealing with interracial marriage. So I understand the objection. We hear it a lot. It didn't happen around racial diversity in marriage, and I don't think it will happen around sexual diversity in marriage.
Okay, thanks for the call, Nathan. And on to Mary, who's joining us from Wanakee. Hey, Mary.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
One of the things that I heard your guest say was that the basis for marriage was reproductive. But I think Wisconsin Public Radio interviewed a guest a number of years ago who said that marriage had actually been instituted in the Middle Ages, and it was done at that time to ensure the creation of and the passing on of properties and power. It had nothing to do with love. It had nothing to do with anything else. That marriage was instituted to ensure that families retained power and retained the land.
Well, you've been listening to public radio. That's good.
You had. You ought to come teach my class on marriage. Mary, yeah. You're absolutely right as an historical matter. Marriage mirrored a kind of feudal relationship between families, just like the state represented a kind of feudal relationship between the state and the people that it organized. And marriage was essentially a property relationship. When a woman was married, her legal identity transferred from her father to her husband. She never had her own legal identity. And we reformed those laws. In the 19th century, they were called Married Women's Property Acts, where women could have their own legal identity, have their own bank account, be separate as a legal person from their husband. But historically, marriage was really a property relationship. Now, I don't think the defenders of heterosexual marriage, exclusive heterosexual marriage today, would come into court and say, well, essentially marriage is a property relationship that's about passing wealth from one generation to another. It's just a somewhat outdated notion of what marriage is, but it's certainly historically correct that that's what it is. And many of the laws we have, the inheritance laws, the tax laws, the ways of being able to put your partner on your health insurance, these all are vestiges of that notion of property being able to be passed from one spouse to the other and up to certain limits between generations.
We've got an email here from Barbara in Wausau who says, the case can be made that gay marriage is good for everyone. Citizens marrying stabilizes my society. Gay people are citizens, and therefore gay citizens marrying stabilizes society.
Well, that's the conservative argument for same-sex marriage, and there are many, many conservatives who've crossed over to favor it for that very reason. And so Barbara's articulated it, I think, very well.
Well, thank you for that, Barbara, and thanks to Mary for the call before. And let's take another call. Dan joins us from Eau Claire. Hi, Dan.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was curious if your guests would have any knowledge about what Dr. Martin Luther King may have thought about the gay rights situation back in his time. I know he was our leader of civil rights, and now that this has become a civil rights issue, does he have any things on record or speeches about how he felt being also a man who was a believer in the Bible? How did he ever bring that into any of his feelings about gay rights and gay marriage?
He didn't. And, you know, the gay rights movement was really so young at the point when he was doing most of his writing and before he was killed, assassinated, that the issue of gay rights as a political civil rights cause, the way we think of it today, was just not on the political agenda in the 60s. So he didn't write about it publicly. What's interesting is his family, his children and his wife, have come out with different views on same-sex marriage, some adamantly opposed to it, grounding their opposition in religious principles, and others saying, actually, this is a continuation of the legacy of Dr. King. So there's a disagreement within the family and the followers of King's message about how the same-sex marriage movement might relate to Dr. King's civil rights agenda. But we don't know from him where he would come out on it.
Interesting. Well, thank you so much for bringing that up, Dan. And we've got a few minutes left here. One thing I'm curious about, you know, in the previous 4 years, we have seen same-sex marriage tackled as an issue for the states. And I guess if these Supreme Court cases go down one way or another, that could change. But what do you think is the future of the state's involvement in same-sex marriage?
Well, if the Supreme Court finds that it is unconstitutional to prohibit same-sex couples from the institution of marriage, to bar them from marriage, then that will overrule all of the state constitutions and state statutes that limit marriage to heterosexual couples. So it takes it out of the hands of the states, essentially. So the similar kind of thing would be many states had racially segregated schools at the time that the Brown versus Board of Education case was decided. And when the court said, you can't segregate people on the basis of race, that had the effect of overruling all of those state laws, whether they were at the state level or the local level, that segregated students on the basis of their race. So it really depends on what the court does. They could have a broad statement of this is discrimination in overruling all those state laws, or, as I said before, it could do something quite technical, and then the battle will continue state by state.
Now, we've got about a minute left, and you said before that you are one of those who was moved by the president's words on Monday in support of gay rights, in support of gay marriage, and it does seem that the winds of history, as you point out, may be blowing. Do you think that you are going to be here to witness a historic shift in the terms of gay rights and marriage equality over the next several years, and how long do you think it's going to take?
Well, I think we are witnessing it. I think it's quite clear that shift has taken place. But one thing we didn't hear him say, not a peep, was about reproductive rights. The early gay rights movement was about sexual rights and would have included questions of women's reproductive liberties and equality within their movement. But today's gay rights movement doesn't so much. And as we've seen the needle move so rapidly in terms of diminishing stigma against gay people, such that Jodie Foster can stand up at the Golden Globes and sort of come out, and have that be kind of quaint, actually, the needle has moved the other direction in terms of enhancing stigma towards women who have abortions or towards the general issue of reproductive rights. And I think that's really where we want to have the work continue in the next few years.
And we have to leave it there. But Catherine Franke, thank you so much for being with us this hour.
Oh, thank you, Veronica, for including me.
Catherine Franke, professor of law and director at the Center for Gender and Sexuality Law at Columbia. Rhonda Fanning and Amanda Magnus produced this one, and Rob Ferret answered your calls. I'm Veronica Rickert on the Ideas Network.